Hey guys, welcome to a very special episode of Cartel Aristocrats. This week, Jeremy is on vacation in Hawaii and is unable to connect with the internet he has at his hotel. So it's just going to be Ed and I doing it. As always, we'd like to thank our sponsor, CoolStuffInc.com, for providing $25 gift certificates for us to give away. With free shipping on orders of $100 or more, you can find Cool Stuff Inc. for all your Magic the Gathering and board game and other game needs. How are you doing today, Ed?
I'm pretty tired. I literally just got back from Japan like 6 hours ago at this point. So, and I had a pretty long ride getting back. So I'm pretty beat, needless to say. And I'm only here for a few days before I leave for Los Angeles on Friday.
Well, at least that's not that far away. You're in Portland right now, right?
Yes.
All right. So is there anything about at the Grand Prix that you noticed that there was a Grand Prix in Japan, right? I'm not like making this up.
There was a Grand Prix in Japan 2 weeks ago. This past weekend, it was actually a doubleheader. I believe Jeremy was here in Portland for the GP here, and I was actually in Liverpool.
Oh, okay. So what was going on over there? Did you see anything interesting with like UMA prices of in Europe versus the North America?
The most important thing that I've noticed, and generally the trend for master sets, especially in the past, is that prices tend to be a little bit higher, and part of that is just due to product costing more in Europe. Especially in the UK, boxes do cost a fairly substantial premium. For the stores that are actually inside the UK, box, you're looking at like your consumer is probably spending about like close, if not more than $300 a box, which compared to us, like $300 is far, far more than like what anyone would realistically pay. Imagine like your average consumer in the US probably spends $240 to $250. 260 maybe I'm not really sure. I haven't really followed what price they're at, mainly because I just wasn't buying them here. But that does kind of have a trickle down effect, because if people are spending more on boxes, people naturally want more in their cards. Box toppers definitely cost more there. Again, mainly because boxes cost more, people expect more for their box toppers, and you have some box toppers that are just naturally more expensive in Europe anyways, and that's just kind of due to like the arbitrage that's always existed.
That's interesting. How does the overseas effect happen for like things like promos that are not available there, like SDCC things and the Guilds of Ravnica Mythic Edition? Were those like considerably more expensive overseas?
SDCC, yes, mainly because that's, you know, like very clearly like a US product, right? It's just not available overseas unless you physically had someone that came over here, bought them, and then brought them back. Right? Because like even when it was available on the like the Hasbro web store, having them ship it overseas just wasn't an option. Mythic editions, slightly less rare, mainly because you had you've kind of had multiple events since they've been introduced where they were available in Europe. I think it started out with like Lille back in October. Warsaw was last month. I want to say like, obviously there's Liverpool this past weekend. I want to say there was another one, but I can't remember off the top of my head. But like Mythic like edition is available out there. Obviously like it's a little bit hard to get because, you know, similar to the San Diego Comic-Con, it was available on the web store, but they wouldn't it wasn't available to ship overseas, so it is a little bit more rare, but like it's definitely still out there on the marketplace if people wanted to pick up.
Okay, well those are always interesting insights, because myself personally, I don't do a lot of traveling to events, so I don't really have a firm grasp of like what kind of arbitrage there is overseas. And like, since you go all the time, I figured this is a good opportunity to pick your brain about that kind of stuff. But I'm sure a lot of people are interested in UMA things. So it's now been, this is the second week it's been released, right?
No, it was released on Friday. This is still the first week.
It's the second calendar week that it's been released, right?
Yes.
So I noticed that over the weekend, a lot of staples got really low on TCG Player, like on Saturday, and unfortunately I did not pull the trigger and buy most of them, but there's still like a pretty large discrepancy in the price of the box toppers. Just personally, I've noticed that like TCG market price is not like a particularly helpful indicator of like how much cards actually cost, but it's very rare that there's usually such a large gap between what the market price is for a card and what the like lowest available price for a card is. And it seems to me like not a lot of them are actually selling at the prices that they're at. And even some of them, like I think Gaddock Teague just like continues to go down. And I'm just wondering if you were seeing a similar thing at the Grand Prix. Was there like a rush to get rid of them? Were people more interested in holding them? Which ones were selling better? Like what vendors were actually interested in picking them up?
So two parts of that question. So first, I'll address the market thing. Like, I'm not completely sure how TCG Player actually calculates, like, the market value. Like, I know it says, like, if you click on the help button, it says, like, the last sell price or whatever. But I've definitely, like, seen cards that, like, the market price just makes no sense. Like, obviously, like, in the scenario that you described, the market price is much lower than the actual listing price. Like, that's a relatively obvious one, right? Like, it's usually, like, symptomatic of, like, a buyout, low supply or something where people aren't actually paying the inflated price. But there are times when I've seen the opposite.
So I just want to stop you for a second. There are cards that are like that where the market price is lower than the lowest available. But, like, Gaddock Teague is actually the opposite. The market price is $52, but the lowest available is $42, which leads me to believe that people keep listing them and nobody's buying them.
Right. So, like, that's definitely bizarre, but I've definitely seen cards sell and either, like, the API, like, it's not, like, updating correctly and, like the information that's being presented is not the same as what I'm seeing. Because if you go in on the back end, for people who list cards manually on TCG Player without the use of Crystal Commerce or something, if you actually try and go in on the back end, you can actually see that the number of the last sold price is actually different than what shows up on market at times. So like I'm like a little wary of using market as an indicator for things. It's obviously great for things that like there's a ton of supply on, but like a lot of these oddities, like I am a little wary to use market as like as a data point. But regardless, to kind of address like the box toppers as a whole, I don't know if it was actually the case in Liverpool. Mainly because I wasn't really like paying attention to that part of it. But I know in GP Portland, the box toppers were actually on the prize wall, so people could actually go exchange 300 prize tickets, which is like the equivalent of like 30 booster packs, basically, to get a prize topper. And from what I heard from a lot of my vendor friends who were here at the event in Portland, they said that basically a lot of people were just going around like by late Saturday or Sunday or whatever with like the big prize ticket events, the big payouts or whatever. And people, they were just going around the vendors trying to shop their box toppers, right? I basically just, you know, hoping they crack something expensive and just turn it over for cash right away. To me, that suggests that there's a lot of it just kind of hitting the market. I don't know if that's going to continue in the future. I would assume that for like GP Vancouver and GP Prague, because there's so much emphasis on Ultimate Masters, because the main event is Ultimate Masters, that might still be the case. But I don't imagine like for GP Oakland or any of the ones following afterwards that they'll continue to put these box toppers on the prize wall. So, like, I think right now it is the initial rush. I remember talking with like some other people kind of towards the beginning of the weekend, where your average consumer, if they're just buying like one or two boxes and they don't open like the exact box topper they want, which is very realistic, right? Like if you're a Commander player, you probably have like six box toppers you want to open, right? If you're playing Modern or something, you have like, you know, kind of like 10 or something that you want to open, less if you have a specific set of decks. But I imagine most people would just look at the box topper as a way to reduce the cost of the box rather than actually trying to gain value from the box topper itself. And I imagine as a result, you just have a lot of people that, again, if they were one of the lucky ones to open one of the ones they needed, that's great for them. If not, they're probably just trying to immediately sell back to recuperate like anywhere from, you know, $30 to like $100 or $200 towards their box costs.
Right. No, I agree. Is there any like insight you have into like which ones you think have been selling more, like which ones are more popular? Is it just like you can just look at the price and it should tell you, or is there like more behind that? Like, are there some that are higher demand but like haven't really crept up very much?
It doesn't feel quite as clear cut to me, like why certain ones are the way they are. Like I think kind of like the glowing anomaly here is Eternal Witness. It sees like somewhat fringe modern play. You kind of see it in like collected company decks. But like the large driving force of Eternal Witness is it's like the like third best green card in EDH or something. Right? Like it's like that's a big factor in the price. And even though it's like been printed like to ground multiple times, right? There's I think like four or five actual printings of this of Eternal Witness itself. It's been you can get the obviously the normal set foils in Master Modern the original Modern Masters and Fifth Dawn. You have the FNM promo. That has different art. You now have Ultimate Masters, which has a different art, and then you have the box topper itself as well. But yeah, like that box topper is, I want to say it's like $60 or something. So like that one like doesn't quite add up. Like to me, it's like I understand more why, you know, like Liliana or Tarmogoyf would be expensive, but like there's a few odd ones that like just don't quite make sense.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised by the Bitter Blossom. Like, I don't think that fairies are particularly popular in Modern, but they might be like popular among like a small subset of people. Is how I'm feeling about it, because that one's also like $75, and that didn't strike me as a kind of card that would be nearly that expensive.
Which card again? Sorry,
Bitter Blossom.
Oh, okay, yep, yeah, that one's also kind of odd. It's like there's a judge promo.
There's the judge promo with different art. There's the Masters one, and then there's the regular Shadowmoor, I guess is where it's from. I don't know what it originally
said. Morningside.
Morningside. Okay. But yeah, like there's already a bunch of different foils of it. I'm surprised that this one is so expensive.
Yeah, like again, same thing. Like it's interesting, right? Because like I guess part of it is because all the box toppers technically have the same rarity, as it were. It seems to somewhat be connected on the I imagine like part of it is like the demographic of player that would be interested in foiling out their deck. Mm. Right, like Cavern of Souls, for example, there isn't a huge spread between like the set foils from Master 17 AVR and now UMA and the box harp itself. Like you would think there'd be a bigger gap, but there isn't. And I met like, and Cavern of Souls is kind of, I don't really know how to describe that card. Like it's kind of an EDH card.
Yeah. I mean, it's an EDH card. If you can afford it, it's a luxury item. Like it's just like a Metalworker or like previously like a Gaia's Cradle or, like Phyrexian Tower and Phyrexian Altar before now. So it's definitely more of a, like a luxury card in Commander, but people do definitely play it.
Yes. Yeah. So again, but, like, go ahead, Fish.
Well, I was just going to say, like, to like bring that one home, that one's so expensive because it's a land, it makes any color of mana, it goes in any deck, and, like, it sees a ton of play in Modern and Legacy. So that one doesn't really surprise me. It's just, like, Bitter Blossom's not the one that you see very often. Like, you're not just like, oh, yeah, this is, like, the crux of my deck. Like, I need to have Bitter Blossoms for my deck to function. Whereas if you're playing, like, the Humans deck in Modern, you don't have Cavern of Souls, like I don't know how you're supposed to cast your spells.
But part of that is like most people probably aren't looking necessarily to be foiling out their Modern deck, right? So I think like that's why, whereas like Bitter Blossom you only need one, so maybe like you're more inclined to be spending like on a Bitter Blossom, right? It's like a sideboard card or whatever. You'd be more inclined to spend money on it if you just need one, whereas trying to buy like four box topper foils is a fairly hefty investment. Unless you already own like the entire deck in foil or whatever. So, but again, you have like some fairly like popular commander ones, like, you know, cards like Ulamog Mikaius, right? Like, those are all three cards that are like very, very heavily played in EDH, but not terribly expensive. Like kind of in relation to like where all of them are. They're fairly like middling ones, right? I think like cards
They're between
like
like $40 and $60.
right, like not like which is far cheaper than what the actual set foil prior to UMA was,
Right.
right?
No, I definitely agree. Like, I even purchased a cause like an Ulamog foil because, or the box topper promo because, like, it was cheaper than regular, like, non-foil Kozilek and Ulamogs were not that long ago. Like, even just before they got reprinted in Masters 2015, and even like pretty recently, they were getting pretty expensive. They were like $30 or $40 each.
So, yeah, I think as a whole, we probably won't be moving on to the next topic. I think we've kind of touched on a decent amount. Like, box toppers are definitely kind of like a little bit different here. It's definitely not something we've seen before. It definitely kind of like is a throwback, I guess, except Wizards hasn't done before, but it's like kind of a throwback to like sports cards where they usually have like these unique type items in sports cards. For anyone who does deal sports cards, there's like infinite rarities for sports cards. You have like some exceedingly rare items that you can only get as a box topper. And that kind of like throws a wrench on like the whole EV calculation. I imagine we'll have to kind of see it play out, mainly because box toppers, I think, are rapidly approaching their high supply at this point, whereas normal UMA cards haven't yet. And part of that is due to kind of like what Channel Fireball is doing, because they're forced to like run drafts or like running like a sealed PTQ or something. They're opening a bunch of product and they just have these loose box toppers. Same with stores, if they're wanting to open boxes for loose packs, they're basically keeping the box toppers for themselves, right? Which is totally their right, because there's no reason it's kind of hard for them to sell individually sealed because people know they can be searched. Like, people aren't really looking to buy them sealed. People want to buy the singles. And right now, like, if like you either have sealed boxes, which people will want to buy sealed boxes because they want the box topper inside in addition to a sealed product, or you have basically all the box toppers are already being opened or on the market right now. So I imagine like these will slowly start to trend up kind of once the initial like glut that hits the market kind of get sold off or whatever, especially like, you know, come New Year or something when like TCG Player does their kickback, people will probably be kind of buying in mass. And then I imagine like these will start to get pretty rare pretty fast. So I think like buying right now is probably like kind of the peak supply. Whereas like if you're looking to get like the cheapest possible copy, like you like need a play set of like Life from the Loams or something, you can probably afford to wait a little bit longer because people are going to continue to open this product, you know, over like probably through Christmas, probably through New Year, etc.
Do you feel the same way about like the staple cards like Liliana, Karn, Snapcaster Mage, Cavern of Souls, like Noble Hierarch? Do you think those five are things that are continuing to drop, or do you think that players have decided that there's time to start rebuying?
I think people have probably kind of like started to wisen up. I was actually pretty surprised to see like some of the cards like kind of creep up already. And I imagine like kind of mentally people have, at least like the people who like have been waiting, they've kind of like understood how the market is like operating and they're cognizant, like, you know, like Noble Hierarch, right? Like prior to UMA being dropped, like Noble Hierarch was like $65 to $68, and I think mentally, like the smarter players are thinking like, hey, if Noble Hierarch drops down to 40, I should pull the trigger, right? Like $40 is what like Bylas was a month ago, and like if you're saving like 35%, like you should probably be happy with that. I think like the people who are getting punished are the people who are expecting it to drop to like $30 or something, right? Like that's too much of a drop for a card that like is arguably one of the best creatures in Modern, right? It's like definitely the best mana dork ever, right? It's played as a zero or four of, right? People who need it need four. It's not really like the type of card you want to be like trimming copies on. So like it doesn't surprise me that those have started gone up, like to go up again, but it is kind of surprising that it's gone up as quickly as it has. Like, it definitely bottomed out kind of like Friday, and then like it felt like it started to creep up. Either people like weren't willing to sell it that cheap, or like all the cheap copies from vendors who are cracking the boxes just kind of like sold right away.
Okay, that's kind of the same opinion that I have on that subject. Ed, did you want to take a look at some of the questions we have on our CoolStuffInc.com page? Because I know that you mentioned there were a lot of questions that you were very interested in answering.
Yeah, there's definitely like a lot of like questions, which is good. Like, people are definitely posting a lot of stuff. If you ask a question regarding UMA, I probably don't really want to touch on it, mainly because we could just probably like honestly do a whole episode on UMA. I imagine it's like it'll probably be something that we will continue to visit like sporadically, mainly because it's kind of the master sets always throw the market in a wrench. So if you have an answer on UMA right now and we don't answer it, like we'll at some point come back to it or like touch on, like, especially if you're trying to ask like about a specific card. Like, there's like some general advice we could give, but like I wanted to answer more questions and talk about more than just UMA. I'm going to kind of skip over those for now. As for a credit winner, Jim, do you just want to pick a credit winner question, or do we kind of want to start firing off questions before we get to our credit winner?
Well, since I'm Jeremy today, you get to be me today. I mean, geez, you get to choose the person that wins the store credit.
Okay. I will, I guess this is the one that will win, and then we'll answer a few more questions before we wrap up the episode
today. Okay, so who's our winner this week?
Atari Jones.
Okay.
Is the winner. The question is, with a banned restricted update coming next month, I am once again wondering if there is any viable financial strategy that you could suggest involving such announcements. Is it a fool's errand to invest in cards that might someday be unbanned? Is it advised to purchase cards like Birthing Pod when their price tanks soon after banning? Have you had financial success related to ban and restrict announcements in the past? Thanks for the great and entertaining cast. This is a good question. I think it's one of those things that's like kind of constantly in people's mind now, especially because we seem to have more substantial shakeups with the banned and restricted list, as it were. To kind of break this down, so since there's kind of like three like separate questions in this, I'll just kind of touch on them individually, even though they are all linked together. The first part, is it a fool's errand to invest in cards that might someday be unbanned? I don't think so. I think your opportunity cost is relatively low. I had friends that have just, like, prior to Blood Braid Elf being unbanned, you know, like, it was a $3 card for the longest time. You just offer people dollars on them, and you basically be getting them for a very long time. And, like, obviously he was, like, well rewarded when it was unbanned. Like, they popped up in price. So it's definitely not a fool's errand. It just kind of depends on where you want to be. Obviously there's, like, some risks. Like, the risk that you take is that, one, your card might never be unbanned, and two, it's one of those things where you're tying up a lot of your capital. If you have, like, a bunch of cards you can afford to do this, then it's great, but, like, the last thing you want to do is go out and spend, like, you know, like, $500 or, like, $1,000 on all copies of Stoneforge Mystic. Stoneforge Mystic is kind of the one that kind of goes through like a constant like boom bust cycle, where it kind of just gets hyped up prior leading to announcement. Everyone seems to think that, okay, this is going to be it. And at some point it is going to be it. I do feel that it will get unbanned at some point, but I think we're a little ways away from that. I think Modern has a kind of beheaded in a different direction, both philosophically and kind of like practically before that does happen. But there are definitely people who like have capitalized on the cycle. People just know that everyone starts to want to buy it beforehand, so people start to sell them at an inflated price, and then like literally the day after announcement, you can just kind of see a steep drop off where people start looking at selling their Stoneforge Mystics. So if you want to invest, like, just kind of do so wisely. Just kind of take it with a grain of salt that you theoretically could just never be rewarded for, and that's something you have to be okay with. Second part of the question, is it advised to purchase cards like Birthing Pod when their price tanks soon after a banning? Yes and no. I think Birthing Pod is one of those cards that will unlikely ever be unbanned in Modern again, but it is like it's not like the worst casual card. It only has one printing of it, so the price is probably going to continue to creep up due to rarity. I think it's like pushing $8 now, if I remember correctly. They're like reasonably hard to find. You don't really have people that go up and say, oh, I want to sell my Birthing Pod deck. One, because I'd be somewhat impressed if people still have a Birthing Pod deck at this point. But like, you know, once those cards like sell out to people who, you know, put them in cubes, commander decks, etc., they don't really show up back on the market. Birthing Pod is kind of an odd one because of that result. But I imagine something like Golgari Gravetroll, like that's the type of card that will probably just never recover in price, even if it does get unbanned in Modern, which is probably highly unlikely at this point, because that's, I want to say that's one of the few cards that's been unbanned at one point in Modern and got rebanned. I don't actually know if there's another card that where that
I believe that is the only card that has been unbanned and then rebanned, because it was okay without the Shadows over Innistrad stuff, but once they printed Prized Amalgam and now Purple Angel, I think that Golgari Grieftroll is going to live on that ban list forever. Like, I don't think there's any, like, there's definitely, so I think that part of the thought experiment here is, like, figuring out which cards are the cards that are most likely to come off the ban list. Golgari Grieftroll, like, if 10 is most likely and 0 is least likely, like, Golgari Grieftroll is like a 1. Like, it's not impossible, but it doesn't feel like it's ever going to, like, there's never going to be a good reason to take it off, unless it becomes like a super weird rotating format where they just ban and unban things every 6 months because they feel like it. But I don't feel like that's ever going to happen. But I think that there's definitely things like Stoneforge Mystic, like Green Sun Zenith, I think is like a pretty reasonable thing to come off the ban list. And maybe even Splinter Twin at some point in time. But like, I don't feel like there's just a couple of, like, the artifact lands are dead forever. Blazing Shoal is never going to get unbanned. Chromax is never going to get unbanned. Cloud Post probably will never get unbanned. Dark Depths, Deathrite Shaman, Dig Through Time, Dread Return, Iavugan, Gataxian Probe. Like, all these things that let you cheat on mana. Hypergenesis, Mental Misstep. None of those things, I think, are ever going to come off. Like, the rituals that they've banned are probably just going to stay banned. There's, like, no good reason to take them off. Punishing Fire is just too good against creature decks. Like, that one's probably in, like, the 5 category in my mind. But, like, Umezawa's Jitte is probably never coming off. Treasure Cruise is probably never coming off. Like, things that let you cheat on mana. Summer Bloom is dead forever. Sensei's Divining Top is banned in Legacy, so, like, I don't know why they would ever want to unban it in Modern, unless they want to, like, make everyone quit. Like, there's just, like, there's some opportunity cost in what you buy, but then they're, like, if you don't buy any, like, if you buy cards that just have zero chance of ever getting unbanned, there's, like, you're just, like, incinerating money for no reason.
Yep. I like, it's definitely one of those things, like, you can, like, think long and hard, but it's one thing to say, like, I want to see Stoneforge unbanned in Modern. It's another thing to think if practically Wizards wants Stoneforge Mystic to be unbanned in Modern, which, again, I think, like, there will be a time where that is the case. It's just, I just don't think it's, like, right now in the immediate future.
It's, you know what it is? It's going to be when they do another Master Set where Stoneforge Mystic and Batterskull are in it. Like, that's just what they're going to do. That's what they did with Jace, right? Like, they preempted the unbanning with another supply wave to get people excited for the card.
Yes, I definitely think that's a very reasonable thing, right? Because, like, at this point, if Stoneforge Mystic were to get unbanned, like, that card would just be so expensive, right?
It would just be like Jace. Even though it's not very good, people think it's good, or they have memories of it being good, and it'll just be expensive just on that alone.
Yep.
I mean, it's a card that, like, very rarely gets played in Commander, and almost as rarely gets played in Legacy, and it's still $20. Like, not that many people play with it, and it's still quite expensive, even having an entire year's worth of GP promos, right? I think that was one of the ones that didn't split. So, yeah, I think that that's definitely a good question to ask yourself, but I think that it's important to take that time to reflect on the card that you're going to try to buy into, and like whether or not it's going to ever get unbanned, and weigh that against like the cost of the card. Like, Birthing Pods are like $8 or $9. You probably don't want to buy a ton of them when you can buy other things, but like if you wanted to spend, I don't know how much Green Sun Zeniths are, but like a similar amount of that, like if you can get two or three Green Sun Zeniths instead of one birthing pod, in the end you may end up being better because you'll just have more copies. But thank you. I'm sorry. What did you say the person's name was?
Atari Jones.
All right. So when you hear this cast, please send me an email at cartelaristocrats@gmail.com. And I'll get you your $25 gift certificate to coolstuffinc.com. If anyone listening wants to win next time, you can leave a question on our article that'll go up probably Thursday, December 13th. And leave a question. And if you get chosen, you can win a $25 gift certificate to coolstuffinc.com. All right, what's our next question, Ed?
Kind of changing the tune of this. Even though you aren't a winner, Charlie Hanford, he asks, do you think, given the recent esports announcement, that Wizards would ever move away from Paper Magic being a legal tournament format? This may provide Wizards an opportunity to break the reserve list without violating its reprint policy, which states all policies described in this document applies only to tournament legal Magic cards. I think the reserve list is kind of like a sub issue here. I think kind of like the main point that I'm choosing a question is, I think we kind of want to like, I would like to like touch on kind of the esports announcement that was made on December 6th, last week, last Friday or something. So I think like a lot of people have kind of talked about it, and like, I guess I can just kind of give my own general opinion. I'll touch on the specifics of your question, but I think the concept of esports pushing being the direction that Wizards wants to push in, I don't think is necessarily pushing Paper Magic away. I think it's one of those things that people have to be cognizant of, right? Like if we think of kind of the market cap for Wizards, like the axis they operate on, right? Like who are the major players? You have like your game stores and you have like kind of casual players, and like game stores, you have people that are the game stores are focused on bringing in like competitive players, right? They're trying to fuel like the grindier type. They're trying to sell like pro, like fundamentally they're the ones that are trying to sell the pro tour dream, right? Like you start here, you like start winning FNM, right? Like formerly you'd be able to work your way up. You win a PBDQ, right? You're like, you take a trip somewhere, you play in kind of like a regional PTQ where you have kind of like the best in their area, like people who are able to win their own PBTQs playing against each other as a shot for the pro tour, where like local game stores kind of fuel that dream, right? They also provide a way for casual players, right? People who don't care about like the pro tour, people who don't care about competitive Magic, as a way for, they can either come in, they can play casually, or, you know, they might be the type of person that you see once every 3 months. You know, they show up for the pre-release, they pick up their box, and then you just don't see them again until the next set drops. Right? So, like, regardless of how they operate, right, like, Paper Magic is relatively close to its market cap, right? Like, there's not many places where you can't say, like, it, like, as, like, you know, if you're on the board at Hasbro, you can't say, oh, let's just open more game stores. Let's just have people open up more game stores, we'll sell more Magic. Like, that's not how Paper Magic is working, right? Realistically, there's only so many people you can get into playing Magic. Sure, you have kind of a reasonable turnover rates, you know, like high school students, that's kind of like the demographic that Wizards wants to target, for example, right? Because you're like good players, they don't have a ton of disposable income, but Magic can be a relatively cheap hobby, right? You can play FNM on the cheap, you can play casually for cheap. It's a good place for people to get started, right? And then in like, if it works out, then you have a player for three to five years. I imagine that's not an unrealistic expectation for what Magic player should be, right? But there's only like, there's a very finite cap on those. Whereas if we look at something like Arena or Magic Online, I imagine that the percentage of players who play in Paper Magic versus play that own Magic Online accounts or like own Arena accounts is very, very low. You probably have a lot of people that play Paper Magic because they like, you know, the being able to interact with your opponent in person. They like to be able to see their opponent across from them. But now, right, like that's a whole new market they're opening up. If they can push Arena, right, like now you can open up kind of your game. You can open up the game of Magic Gathering to a whole new audience, right? Because now you can capture people who don't necessarily care about the like people part of Magic, right? Where and now they see that Arena as an esport. They see it as like a computer game. They see it as something that they can do, you know, at home on their own time when they're watching Netflix or something, right? And that is a much more profitable avenue to Hasbro because there's many, many, many more people they can capture with relatively low effort. Whereas, again, right, like you can't, like with Paper Magic, you can't just say, oh, if we open more game stores, we'll start attracting more Magic players, right? Because you've probably attracted as many people that you reasonably can with what Paper Magic is doing. But now, right, like if we start pushing Arena, like what happens, you know, like one of these like speculation, right? Like what happens if one of these like Mythic championships or whatever is like done via Arena only, right? Like how many people would be watching that, especially if we're looking at like so, like a $1 million prize pool per Mythic championship or whatever the details were, right? Like obviously this is all speculation, but if esports is head, if Magic and esports are headed in that direction, right, that represents a lot of potential growth for Wizards. Like I think I'm kind of like getting off on a tangent, but that's like kind of my thought on it. Relating to this question, Charlie's question, I don't think that Paper Magic would like. I think Paper Magic will always exist. I think the day that like they stop printing new Magic cards is kind of like the day that Magic will die. I think like kind of what you're hinting at here, the reserve list, like it already doesn't exist on Magic Online. They can freely print, like, you know, you have like VMA, like Vintage Masters that exists online as an avenue to freely print power. You have multiple Masters editions, where like Dual Lands, kind of like all these much more narrow, like vintage only type cards have existed. And if, like, realistically, again, if they wanted to push Arena, right, if there ever was a point when, you know, cards, like, they implement, like, a full spectrum of cards on Arena, they could realistically hold a Legacy Pro Tour because card availability, in theory, shouldn't longer be an issue because they don't have to concern themselves with things like the reserve list.
Yeah, I agree that with the crux of what your statement is, like, if they ever stop printing Paper Magic cards, it's not going to be soon, and it's not going to be very quickly. Like, there might be a time where, like, we see that they're favoring Arena tournaments over paper tournaments, and then I might start getting worried. But at this point, I don't think that that's the case. I don't think that they have enough of the history of the game in Arena yet. Like, it's the same thing with why I don't think Magic Online is going to go anywhere anytime soon. Modern and Legacy and Vintage don't exist anywhere except for Magic Online. Like, or I mean, on the internet, they you can't play them on your computer except for Magic Online. And I don't think that the team working on Arena right now is really very excited to go backwards and start adding the sets. And even if they did, it'll take a very long time before they finish. Even if they were to double the size of the teams and they added another set every month, like you have to go 15 years backwards to get all of the cards. Not necessarily all the cards are necessary, but like to get like even just most of the staples for most of the older formats will be very time consuming. So I am not very concerned about that right now. Even if that does happen, though, like I don't think that necessarily Magic is going to. I don't think they're ever going to stop printing paper cards unless the game just doesn't exist at all ever. And like I'm not even sure that at this point in time, I think there are too many people that are too invested that will probably never happen. And if it does, it'll be because of reasons outside of their control. You know, if we start like living at like in like a Fallout universe and we need to pay things with bottle caps, like maybe Magic doesn't exist then. But as long as the world exists as we know it today, or for the most part, then I don't think that there's a really large chance that Magic ceases to exist, especially in paper. Like we got through a really couple bad years of Standard and it was still pretty okay as far as like players were concerned. They just played a different format, which is probably what would happen if it got bad again. But I don't think there's anything to worry about there.
Yeah, just to kind of like put in the scope of how difficult it is to go back and put everything back in Magic Online just for Modern alone. If they want to support Modern, right? Like Modern was first introduced. I mean, Modern was introduced in 2012, right? Which means like Modern is 6 years old at this point, right? Which is roughly 25% of the lifespan of Magic as a whole. If you're going back to the cards that have existed since Modern's printing, you're going back to 2003, which is 15 years at this point. I think they actually crossed the threshold. I remember seeing it on Twitter. I want to say like Mark Rosewater, someone tweeted that. It was some time ago. I will say it was like at least a year ago or something. They had actually passed the threshold where there are more Modern legal cards that in existence in terms of like what cards that exist than cards that don't exist. I did not word that very well at all. There's more Modern cards than non-Modern cards, basically. Not in terms of physical quantity, but like cards.
There are more individual cards that are legal in Modern than there are not legal in Modern.
Yes.
That is what you were trying to say. And I agree with that.
Yeah. And like that is a monumental task to go back and just try and like put it all into Arena. So I think Arena has like a very, very big future. I do think that a lot of their energy will go towards Arena. Especially because like, you know, to kind of touch on your question, right? Like addressing like the reserve list issue, right? Like that may be some point in the future, but I think there's quite a bit of ways to go for Arena as a whole, before we do kind of have to worry, as it were, as if there was something to worry about.
Yes, I very much agree with you. Just a little tidbit of information. When Magic Online first came out, the first set that was released was Invasion. That was before Modern even existed. So, and
that was in 2001, I think, yes. When Magic Online first came out.
Yes. I played a lot of Magic Online with like $3 and some string because that's all my parents wouldn't let me buy digital booster packs. I wonder why. But, you know, there's so much time and effort put into like what Magic Online is right now that even if they wanted to do it in Magic Arena, like, it's like at least a 6 year out project. Like there's no way that they could finish in any time shorter than that. And at that point, why, I don't know if there's anything to worry about. So Ed, what next question caught your eye?
So also kind of in the same vein, David Moe, will the impact of the Wizards announcement into putting more money into Pro Magic help out with card prices staying more stable in the paper world, or also help impact bigger, quicker spikes as people wanting these top decks to start playing as a result of big tournaments? This is definitely an interesting one. I think it kind of depends on the shift of how people react. Right? Like, if, like, I like Twitter for this reason. I think you just kind of get kind of a very much like day-to-day perspective. There's a lot of pros who really, really, really like Arena. Like that's no surprise, right? Like it's right. Like just like, I haven't played Arena myself. I own a Mac. I haven't like gone through the efforts to get it. I might buy a second like Windows OS or Chromebook or something to be able to do this.
And you can run it through Wine, but
Sure. I could do all these things, yes. But like my time is just not there to do that. Regardless, right? Like just watching people stream Arena. I've said this in the past like few casts. Like I'm very impressed with Arena. It looks very good. It is a good. It's just a very, very good user friendly tool. Like the interface looks nice. It's well done for lack of a better way to put it. If we do see a lot of like. Of this money, depending on where it goes, right? Like if it goes into Arena, right, and it becomes more visible, I do suspect that we might see kind of like a surge in like Modern, depending on how it exists, right? Like I think it's a little ways away from that, right? Because we just talked about it, right? Like Modern might not exist on Arena right away, right? But like obviously Standard does, right? What, like, if we start seeing, right, like these like mini arena only tournaments, like what if we see like an arena Magic Fest or something come up next year, right? Like, these things aren't outside the realm of possibility. I do think that, you know, if we do see a huge surge, kind of like a surge of players that enter the game, right, it'll be somewhat similar to kind of the growth that we saw in Magic from starting with like RTR kind of in like 2012, 2013, when Wizards was basically reporting like, oh, we just have, you know, like a ridiculous amount of growth, like exponential growth compared to last year. And then the following year, it's like, oh, we just saw exponential growth again, right? There's just so many people getting in at that time. And I think Arena is, like, it wouldn't surprise me if there's kind of like another like Renaissance era coming with Arena, like if it does attract a lot of players, right? Because obviously, like, the dream for like most game stores is, you know, you have a customer that comes in, hey, I watched some Arena on Twitch, right? Like, you know, like the Mythic Championship I saw on Twitch, right? Like, it, like the I saw an advertisement for Arena, I played some Arena, this game looks super fun, right? And now they're starting to buy paper cards, right? Like, that's the perfect transition. That's exactly what Wizards wants. And I think it's very possible, like, Standard is probably going to see it first, right? It wouldn't surprise me if you start seeing kind of bigger Standard spikes as more and more people are trying to, you know, get into Standard. And Standard is in a reasonable place right now where, one, it's like, I feel like it's pretty sweet. Like, it feels like it's a little slanted too heavily towards aggro decks for my liking, but there's like a decent amount of diversity. And the decks, like, to be honest, if you compare it to some of the past Standard decks, not terribly expensive, right? Even if we do see like a 25% increase in prices, right? Like, again, like, I know, like, it might mean more to some people than to me, right? But that's like a $50 increase, right? Which is not unreasonable to be building a Standard deck compared to some Standards of the past. So I do think, like, if we kind of see like this huge boom in Magic popularity again, you might start looking at like some bigger spikes like that happen as people like who are vested, like, or they want to start transitioning from like what they see online to paper, that we might start seeing like prices kind of jump around more quickly.
So bring this all back to me. How do you feel, like, what's your short version of the answer to this question?
I do think that, like, the market will be quicker to react as it has been in the past, right? Like,
So it'll be less stable.
Yes, less stable, more spiky, as it were.
I agree with you entirely. I don't want to reiterate everything that you said, but I agree. When there are more players and formats like Ravnica, where you're just kind of can play whatever you want, and it changes a lot what the best deck of the week is, and people change often, that will cause a lot more price changes. With people entering the market and buying into new decks that maybe not have opened a lot of Magic cards previously, will also cause this kind of effect to happen. So if Arena is successful in bringing people onto paper, the paper market will be more volatile, not less volatile.
Yes, that is summing up what I said much more eloquently than how I said it.
I mean, there was nothing wrong with what you said. I just wanted to summarize in case anyone lost track of what we were trying to say.
Yes. Thank you for that.
Do you have another question you'd like to read off?
I think we can. Let's see.
We'll do one more and then do pick of the week.
Do you want to answer this question for Jim?
Sure. I am Jim, so I think I'd be very well qualified to answer this question.
All right. It is. Let's see. How do you organize and keep track of your spec purchases? I've currently got 800 count box that I've got organized by set, but I'm thinking about reorganizing it into short term, 0 to 3 months, midterms, 6 to 12 months, and long term, 12+ months, and then subdivide by format. I find keeping track of everything the hardest, despite checking sites like MTG Stocks every day.
Personally, I do not buy very many things that I intend to keep a long time. Most recently, I bought some cards from Ixalan, and I bought some cards from Magic 2015. And I've been sitting on them, and I'm just actually been kind of lazy. I need to just sell them, so I'll probably post them on Twitter later. But basically, my thought process is either I'm going to buy it with the intentions of selling it again quickly, or buying it and throwing it in a box and forgetting about it, and then eventually it'll be worth money, and then I'll sell it. I don't really have like very strict timelines. Like, yeah, I'm going to get out of this in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year. Like, that's not how I operate when I buy cards specifically for speculation purposes. At this point, most of what I end up purchasing is just cards that I want to play with. And if I think it is a particularly good buy, I will buy extra copies to sell later. But the impetus for me to purchase cards at this point is strictly for playing with them. So, like, I bought Vivian Reeds because I didn't want them to get more expensive when Standard started playing them more. So, you know, I bought them at like $5 or $6. That my main concern there was whether or not I was going to be able to play with them. At this point, they're an exorbitant amount of money compared to what I paid for them. I'm very happy to just get rid of them and then buy it again when it rotates or whatever. I wasn't expecting it to go quite as high as it is. I think they're like $20 or $30 now, which is a little bit too much that for a standard card at this point. I don't really need to keep them, but I don't necessarily like go check every day to see how much it is. Like, in my day-to-day life, in looking at Twitter, I see, you know, oh, this deck won with these cards, and I very loosely keep up with the cards in the formats that I own. So like, I almost exclusively at this point just buy short-term standard things to sell. So I watch streamers sometimes play Magic. I watch YouTube videos or whatever, and I just like have them on in the background when I'm working. I really don't have like a very strict way to sort all my stuff. Like, things that I know that I've purchased that I'm gonna like keep for a very long time and then eventually sell. Like, that's just in a box. It's just in a single box. It's alpha sorted, and then that's it. Like, when it's ready, when it pops, I'll sell it and I'll be gone. I'll be done with it. But there's not that many of those cards that I actually end up purchasing. I don't recommend, if you're not like, if you enjoy doing this, then I think your method is probably the best. But if you just want to be lazy about it, like I mostly am, I wouldn't recommend purchasing a ton of cards with the intentions of selling them.
I think as a whole, kind of like your strategy about keeping track of your expectations, I think like your organization is great. Like, the worst thing you want to do is just like realize that, oh, this card spiked. I have no idea where the card is, which I've definitely had that issue before. I don't think you need to quite be as diligent about keeping track of it, right? Mainly because, like, I imagine that you have a relatively small sub, like, your 800 account box, in your case, I don't know how many different cards you own, right? But, like, when I spec on cards, I usually own, like, a million of them. Like, not literally a million, right? I own a lot. Like, my for example, if I had an 800 count box, it would probably contain like 8 different cards. I would have like 100 copies of 8 different cards. I think just, again, you just want to keep tabs, right? Just like, know, you know, like, what is the scenario where this card gets expensive? Right, in the case of like, you know, using Jim's example for Vivian Reed, like, it's very clear that it was never going to be a long-term spec. It's like, okay, we have like Golgari coming out in Guilds of Ravnica. If a black green deck that is grindy is going to be successful, it's probably going to play Vivian Reed, right? Like, and like, that's a scenario where it gets expensive, which it did get expensive. Okay, now it's time to get out of it. Just kind of be cognizant of what your specs look like. Again, I don't know what your specs look like. It's different for every person. So just be aware of what they look like, at what price point you want to get out of them. And just be ready, like, you know, if it does go up, like, you want to be one of the very first people to capitalize on the spike, because you're going to be the one that's going to get the most. So, like, that's kind of what I do. I do look at, like, MTG stocks on a fairly regular basis to kind of see what the market looks like. It's hard to, like, pinpoint, like, exact, like, website that has all the data that you need, mainly because each website presents them in a different way. Like depending on which API they scrape the data from, whatnot, right? There's a lot going on that makes it hard to like definitively know, like, okay, what's going to spike, or even if it did spike, right? Because MTG stocks, it reports like some pretty sad spikes, to be honest. Like an increase in 5% is not something to write home about. That's just natural market fluctuations.
I mean, increase of 5% could be a penny, really. Like it depends on the price of the card.
Right. You have like definitely like sub like $10 cards where 5% is like 50 cents, right? Like that's like just day-to-day variation. So I think like what you're doing is great. Again, just kind of like if your organization works for you, like that's ultimately what it comes down to, is just like what makes sense and what works the best for you.
All right. So now it's everyone's favorite time, pick of the week. And I know that I'm not putting you on the spot because you've already said you already got one. So what is your pick of the week this week, Ed?
I think like just kind of looking at standard cards, this is the best time. A lot of people are looking to sell. A lot of people, like if you look on the Facebook groups, there's a lot of people trying to sell their decks. They're needing stuff for the holidays. I think like Guild of Ravnica is at a relatively stable price point, but at like right now we're a little bit more than 1 month away from Ravnica Legions coming out. That's like kind of what I'll be looking at, right? Like most, like it's still a very, very good spot to get in at the Czech lands that haven't gone up, right? Dragon Skull Summit, Glacial Fortress,
Isolated Chapel, Hinterland Harbor. Crap, what's the last one?
Rootbound
Crag. Yeah, I was like, the Red Dream, what is it called?
Yes, right. Like these are also fairly cheap if you don't own a set, right? Like, we've been talking about this for a while, like, just go own your set, right? Like, look how expensive Steam Vents, look how expensive Flip Drop Retreat is now compared to how they were before Guilds of Ravnica came out.
I mean, even if... Look at Sulphur Falls and say, like, this is the worst case scenario. That's like $8. Do you want to spend $8? You just win $250. Those are your options.
Right, and Sulphur Falls has actually come down, right? It's kind of cooled off, right? Like, if you're trying to play Standard right after the Pro Tour, you're paying, like, $12 for Sulphur Falls.
I know, I did. It was miserable.
Right, so, like, so those lands are kind of obvious. What you also want to be looking at are cards that are somewhat restricted on mana, mainly because the Shockland doesn't exist for it yet. A lot of the mana bases that do exist in Standard right now are four of the Shockland, four of the Czechland. So, like, Teferi is kind of the example. Like, Teferi is already very expensive. Teferi continues to get more expensive, surprisingly. And that's, like, you know, that's, we don't have Hallowed Found yet. What happens when we have Hallowed Found? What happens when we have more Azorius cards? What happens when there's, like, a solid blue-white control deck that exists in Standard? I'm not saying that you have to, like, go on buy your four Teferis, but there are many cards that are kind of in that same vein. I want to say, like, I can't think of any other ones off the top of my head, but like, it wouldn't surprise me if, like, I don't know, Sarkhan Fireblood or something was also good because of cards that could potentially come out, like in like a Gruul card or like some Rakdos card or something. So I don't necessarily have like a specific one, mainly because I think like most of the cards I just named are like fairly reasonable specs. But I think like if you're looking to get in Standard, you kind of like want to make a good short term investment. Like buying some of these cards is definitely not the worst idea.
Okay, I think that's a pretty good strategy here. I'm looking at some like more casually things primarily. So I am interested in oh my gosh, stop web page, Mirage Mirror. It's an artifact that's also a clone, but also clones weird things. It's a very unique card in what it can do. It can clone an artifact, an enchantment, or a land. This is the kind of card that like is not busted right now, but eventually there will be a combo that makes it busted. So, for example, you can use this with Dark Depths. You can copy your Dark Depths, and then it doesn't have any counters on it, so it becomes a merit leash. Like, Dark Depths just got reprinted. People might come onto this as like another, you know, Dark Depths style combo that you can do. And it's really popular in casual circles. People like Cologne Effects a lot. It's a colorless cologne. You know, I know it looks a little weird because it's only until end of turn, but I've seen a lot of people play it. I've seen a lot of people enjoy it. It's only $2 right now. It's from Hour of Devastation, which is a set that, like, not a ton of was open. Not a lot of cards in that set are very expensive. This could be, like, one of the standout rares from the set. So I think that if you have any interest in playing it, I would not be, you know, I would not hesitate to pick up a couple of copies. If you want to go deep on it, this is the kind of card that you, like, throw in a box and forget about it for, like, a year or two. And then, you know, when people, like, start posting on Twitter, like, an infographic with this new card in Mirage Mirror, that's when you, like, break your box out and you sell it. Like, that's how I would, like, keep track of my specs. Is like, oh, these people are really excited about this stuff. That's the thing that happened with, like, Saheeli Rai and Felidar Guardian. I didn't figure that combo out, but I had a bunch of Saheeli Rais because I just, like, drafted that set a bunch. And I was like, oh, good, I could just sell these now when people are, like, really hyped to get them. So it has combo potential. I think it's a card that more people will want to own over time. So I think it's the kind of card that, like, goes into people's collections and never leaves. So my pick this week, Mirage Mirror.
And just kind of to expand beyond that, not to extend this cast any more than we have to, but if you look kind of at the past few sets, most of the cards that actually have gone expensive after they rotate are not like the hyper competitive cards. Most of them are like these really goofy kind of narrow rares that are super casual cards, right? Like if you look at, like, you know, when you think about Aether Revolt, right? Most people don't think, like, you know, what do you think of when you say Aether Revolt? You think of like Walking Ballista and Fatal Push, right? Like those are kind of like the big cards that like people think of when they think of Aether Revolt, right? But the, like, you know, most people aren't thinking about like Paradox Engine, which is actually the second most expensive card in Aether Revolt. Most people don't think about Heroic Intervention, which most people probably don't even know what it does off the top of their head, but is like a very, very good casual card that people love, right? Like Mechanized Production. Like these are the types of cards that generally continue to climb up in value because they're so prevalent in EDH and casual play. Again, as opposed to, you know, Fatal Pushes. Most people already own their set of Fatal Pushes, and it's not, they're not really selling them, but they're not really buying more. Whereas like these casual cards generally tend to do well as people like, you know, Heroic Intervention. If you play a green deck, you probably have Heroic Intervention. Right? Paradox Engine, if you have some, like, you know, goofy mana-based deck, or you do one of like the million broken things in EDH, you probably need to own a Paradox Engine. So Mirage Mirror probably going to be like, is it, it's not gonna be like a $20 card, but it would surprise me if it was like $5 in like a few months' time.
All right. So that's going to be it for the cast this week. My name is Jim Casal. You can find me on Twitter at PHROST _. Ed, where can everyone find you?
I am at Edwin13 on Twitter. I am almost done with events for the year. I will be at Grand Prix Vancouver, I guess, which is technically next year. But for any of you guys playing Pokemon, I am actually in Anaheim this weekend for a regionals event.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me that you're playing like Pokemon Let's Go, and I was like, I need your friend code, and now I'm disappointed.
No, sorry. So I'll be in Anaheim this weekend, and then that'll actually be it for me for the rest of the year. And then we get to start next year.
All right. Just so everyone knows, because Jeremy's on vacation and we'll be a little bit busy, the next cast will not be till after Christmas. Hopefully we'll get something done before New Year's, but don't expect anything next week. We're going to take a little break. Not a whole lot happens anyway, so you're not going to miss anything. And then we'll be back after Christmas with a great new cast with all of the same people. And I hope you enjoyed this punless cast. It's brought to you, of course, by CoolStuffInc.com. So enjoy your holidays, and we'll see you next time.